I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We're about to have a conversation with Dee Dee Guttenplan. Dee Dee Guttenplan is the London correspondent for The Nation magazine, author of The Holocaust on Trial. He's an award-winning writer. He's worked for Newsday. He lives in London. He writes for many magazines. He's written an autobiography, which is different than the other books that have come out about this man, The Life and Times of I.F. Stone, American Radical, The Life and Times of I.F. Stone. And Dan Guttenplan, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks very much. I just want to... It's a biography of I.F. Stone, not an autobiography of me, although I spent a long time in it, so it feels a little bit like an autobiography.
Did I say autobiography? Did I say that? I'm sorry.
You did, but that's fine. I just want to make sure your listeners know that they're getting I.F. Stone and not me.
Right. This is not the biography, autobiography of Dee Dee Guttenplan. So I'm just interested also, let's start begin with how you, why you as a journalist and as a journalist with an opinion, as I.F. Stone had, decided to kind of delve into this man's life and write a biography on the heels of the other books that have come out about him.
Well, first of all, when I started in 1991, none of the other books had come out. But it's also true that as time went on, none of them did what I wanted to do. I should explain that I had had a rather weird career. I'll be autobiographical for a second.
Please
here.
Do. It's fine.
And that I started in book publishing. And I worked backwards. So I went from being in book publishing to Vanity Fair, which was a monthly, to Newsweek, which was a weekly, to The Village Voice, which was a weekly, to New York Newsday, which was a daily. And in the course of that, I did a fair amount of investigative reporting. I also wrote a media column for Newsday for a while. And as every investigative reporter, I think, in the United States, certainly in our lifetime, I looked up to I.F. Stone as the master of our craft. But I never met him. I didn't know him. Mm-hmm. And when he died, I covered his memorial service for my newspaper. But I think, you know, personally, I was getting a little restless. I was beginning to feel that the kind of work I was doing on newspapers wasn't entirely satisfying because you were always writing about something without knowing very much about it. So I wanted to really learn about something and really immerse myself. Now, I have to say that my definition of immerse myself when I started was 3 or 4 years, not 18 years, which is how long it took me to do this book. But Izzy turned out to be both more complicated and much more fascinating than I thought. But the one thing that I realized at the beginning and is, in a way, the short answer to your question is that when I looked at Stone's life to think about whether I wanted to write about him, I realized that he had, from the moment he walked off a job at the Philadelphia Record in 1927 because his boss wouldn't let him cover the execution of Sacco and Vanzetti, he had been in the middle of every struggle on the left in America from that time forward. He wrote in favor of the CIO when the CIO was getting started. He wrote muckraking pieces in the Nation and in the New York Post about AFL corruption and the way in which that kind of unionism was holding the left down. He was a very active voice against fascism and the rise of fascism in Europe, but also the sort of rise of domestic fascism in the United States and the rise of appeasement here. And, you know, in the 50s, he was a courageous lone voice against McCarthyism. He was one of the very few people who were able to carry on and speak out in the 1950s. And then, of course, in the 60s, interestingly, he was one of the very few, perhaps the only figure really from his generation to have credibility with the New Left and SDS and the people who were mm-hmm. opposing the Vietnam War. So that when the SDS, Students for Democratic Society, were trying to figure out what were the most important issues of the day, they asked I.F. Stone to come and speak to them. And he said, well, you know, there is this war going on, and because of the witch hunts, there's no peace movement in the country anymore. Those people have been demoralized and dispersed. So, you know, if there's nobody really organizing to oppose this war, and he thought that was a really important thing to do, and they listened to him. So what I realized is that, in a way, in addition to telling his life story, which is a pretty interesting life story, I was also going to be able to tell a history of what I call part of the hidden history of the United States, the suppressed history of the left, the history of these long continuities that sustain the movement over decades. And I realized pretty quickly that Neither Myra McPherson, who published a biography of Stone a couple of years ago, nor any of the other writers were really interested in that. They were interested in Stone as a journalist, pretty much pure and simple as a journalist. And I was interested in him as a political actor. That's why my book is called American Radical.
And I think that that's the interesting piece I found about your book. I've read the others as well. And yours is not a dispassionate book. And it's a book that kind of looks at his life in its entirety, as well as having a passion for realizing that, as Stone would say, there's no such thing as an objective journalist.
Well, that's right. I mean, towards the end of his life, Stone always said to his wife, Esther, that if he lived long enough, he'd go from being a pariah to a character to
that.
A national institution.
Right, exactly. And he did.
And he did live long enough.
Yep.
There's a great story I tell in my book that Dick Dudman, who was a good friend of his and who was the Washington bureau chief for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, tells of going to see Stone in the late 40s before he went to Europe for the first time, because he'd admired Stone's columns so much. Stone wrote for the New York left-wing daily PM from 1940 till PM went out of business in 1948. And in a way, that was the cornerstone of his fame. He had this core New York audience who knew him as a columnist for PM and stayed with him for the rest of his life. Anyway, Dudman went to see him to get his advice on writing about the DPs, the displaced persons, the survivors of the Holocaust, who were still, in many cases, cooped up in the same camps that they'd been in during the war. And Stone was, I should say that Stone was not an uncomplicated man, and he was not always a warm and friendly person. And indeed, he could be very forbidding if he thought you were trying to do something on the cheap, or if he thought you didn't know enough about what you were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And he basically told Dudman, I don't think you should go to Europe. You don't know enough to write about this. Dudman's bosses sent him anyway. He came back. Despite that unpromising introduction, he became friends with the Stones. And when Dudman moved to Washington in the mid-50s, he had a dinner party, and he invited Izzy and Esther to dinner. And at that party, there were several other people, because he was a Washington correspondent there, who worked for the government. And one of them took Dudman into the kitchen and said, how can you do this to me? And Dudman looked at him and he said, how can you have me in your house with I.F. Stone? I could lose my job. You know? So he really was a pariah. I mean, when he started I.F. Stone's Weekly in 1953, the sort of independent one-man, four-page newspaper that made him famous for a new generation and that started with 5,000 subscribers and ended in 1971 with 70,000 subscribers. He started out for the first 3 years, he rented an office in the National Press Building. But he gave it up after 3 years because he realized that not one person came to see him who wasn't either a mailman or a telephone repairman.
We're talking about I.F. Stone. The book is American Radical, The Life and Times of I.F. Stone. D.D. Guttenplan is the author. And we're walking through this man's life who really teaches all journalists today about what it means to be a journalist. And I think that I do want to walk through this a little bit historically, but I want to give a sense to our listeners who Izzy Stone was and what he stood for. And then come back and kind of work through his history a bit, because I think this is really so important. I mean, there are a couple of facets. One is that he was not afraid to change his mind. He was not afraid to look at the news and say and change his mind within 2 weeks or a week of writing a story if something happened. He was so open to reality and to the facts of life. And journalists today have lost that. They're always kind of making excuses and hiding behind their mistakes. And he just was very open with everything.
Well, Stone said towards the end of his life that as a journalist, you have a choice. You can either be consistent or you can be honest. In other words, if you're going to worry that what you write this week contradicts what you wrote last week, then you're going to have to start twisting what you write so that you make sure that you're always on the same note, you know, that you never contradict yourself. He said that's one way of having a career, but it means that you can't be honest because evidence comes along. Maybe you thought it meant something last week, but it means something different now, and you need to be able to say that, and you need to be able to not only say it, but say it fearlessly and even alert your readers to the fact that you've changed your mind. My favorite instance of that was in 1956. Stone had been out of the country. He'd been to Israel, and we can talk about that later. He had a long history.
Talk about that. Yes,
you know, he covered the Israeli War of Independence. He was there when in the room when Ben Gurion signed the Declaration of Independence for the State of Israel. He covered it under fire as a war correspondent for PM and for the and for the New Republic. Anyway, in 1956, he went to Israel, and he saw that the state that he hadn't seen for 6 years since 1950 had thrived and was very well prepared, and he said they're prepared for any eventuality militarily. Then he came back to the U.S., and Suez happened, which is to say Israel, the French, and the British invaded Egypt and the Sinai. They took the Sinai, and they seized the Suez Canal, and they only withdrew from this when President Eisenhower forced them to withdraw. He partly forced them by threatening to drive down the value of the British pound if the British didn't withdraw, because the British were, at that point, first of all, that had been part of their empire, and secondly, they were very opposed to Nasser, who was the Egyptian leader.
Mm-hmm.
And when this first happened, Stone thought it was terrific. Well, he didn't think it was completely terrific, but he thought, he wrote about it as if what Britain and France were doing were declaring their independence from the United States. They were showing that they were not going to be part of the American empire. And he said, well, you know, it's a little bit too bad for the Egyptians, but maybe it'll be over quickly, and then, you know, they can make an advantageous peace. But then a week later, he wrote a piece that I think is really unprecedented for a journalist, where he said, well, you know, when it's your own people and it's your own side, you always see things a certain way and you always make excuses, and that's what I did with Suez. You know, that it was my people, it was the Jews, of course. I feel that Israel can't afford to lose a war, so I was pleased that they won. I'm still pleased that they won, but I have to admit that Suez was an imperialist venture, and that far from being sort of brave anti-imperialist, what Israel was doing was colluding with Britain and France in trying to hold on to their empires. And then he wrote something which I think is even more prophetic today than he wrote it in 1956. He said, Israel won this war. Israel will win all of its military wars against the Arabs, but it will never have peace until it learns to make peace with the Palestinians. He said, the road to peace lies through the Arab refugee camps.
And we will come back to that, because I think that's a very powerful part of what he had to say and his roots as a Jewish kid and growing up in this radical bohemian milieu and growing up in this world of the Jewish immigrants in the early part of the 20th century. It was a very special world, even though he grew up in Richmond, Indiana, which I didn't know until I read.
He lived in Richmond, Indiana. He started school in Richmond, Indiana. He really grew up in Haddonfield, New Jersey. And, I mean, that's, in a way, it's like Richmond, Indiana, but closer.
Right, right.
if you're looking at it from the perspective of the Upper West Side or Manhattan or Washington, what he always said, the really significant thing about the way he grew up, because he grew up over the store. His parents had a dry goods store, like, you know, thousands of American Jews all over the country. So they were in a town where there were very few Jews, but they had the dry goods store and they lived above the shop, and that's how he grew up. But what he said is that if you grow up in a small town, it's not like going to City College where the Stalinists were at the throat of the Trotskyists and they were both at the throat of the anarchists in the cafeteria. He said, in a small town, all the radicals know each other and you all have to get along together because there are so few of you. And that, you know, in a way, that became not just part of his experience, but a very important part of his politics.
And it did. It followed him through just many people may not know this, so maybe you can explain a little bit. But in the 30s, one of the major political movements around the left here and around in Europe was this thing called the Popular Front that he deeply believed in.
Well, he deeply believed it, and in a way, it stayed with him for his whole life. I mean, without getting too historical about this, in the 1930s, in the early 30s, in America, there was a big rivalry between the Socialist Party and the Communist Party. Now, Stone's only organized political affiliation in his life was with the Socialist Party. He joined the Socialist Party in New Jersey before he was old enough to vote. In fact, he became the secretary of the New Jersey Socialist Party before he was old enough to vote. He worked on Norman Thomas's presidential campaign in 1928 and was a speechwriter for Thomas in 28 and 32. But he eventually left the Socialist Party because he felt it wasn't radical enough, but he did not join the Communist Party. Anyway, the point is that in the early 30s, these two parties were both competing and doctrinally opposed to each other, although most of the fault for that must lie with the Communist Party, who essentially tried to depict the socialists as allies of fascism because they weren't communists. I mean, the communist view in the early 30s was, if you're not on our side, you're a fascist or an ally of fascist or what they called a social fascist. This was, in Stone's view, a terribly stupid policy and a terribly self-defeating one. And a lot of activists in the United States felt the same way, but the official policy was one of hostility. Nonetheless, you still find lots of grassroots instances of people, for example, if you're organizing sharecroppers in Alabama, if you're trying to organize steel workers in Michigan, if you're trying to organize auto workers, if you're trying to organize, agricultural workers or grape pickers in California, you often have socialists and communists working side by side. For one thing, the same people were trying in many cases to kill them or to run them out of town. So they formed these unofficial alliances, but it was not official policy until after Hitler came to power in Germany. And as Stone always believed, Hitler came to power in part because the socialists and the communists were so busy fighting each other that they didn't bother to fight the Nazis. So after Hitler came to power, in 1935, this became the official policy of the Communist Party, what they called the Popular Front. And the idea was that instead of trying to assassinate everybody on the left and trying to fight all the time, they would join with them to oppose fascism. And it was supposed to be a genuinely broad cooperation. Of course, they would differ on the things that they differed on, but they would cooperate on things like strikes, things like organizing labor movements, things like pushing for civil rights for African Americans in the U.S. And this was in some ways the golden age of Stone's politics. And he was an editorial writer on the New York Post at the time. He came to New York in 1933. And in fact, within a couple of years, before the Popular Front was officially born, Stone organized his own Popular Front because Mayor LaGuardia, who was a Republican officially, but also a member of the Socialist Party, which is a slightly unlikely combination these days. But
not in those days, necessarily.
In those days, it worked, and it meant that he could be independent of the Tammany machine, who were the Democrats in New York, and he could still support Franklin Roosevelt. He was a key ally of Roosevelt's. Anyway, he had a police commissioner who was very anti-left and very anti-red, and whose policemen would beat strikers with nightsticks. There would be demonstrations, because remember, this was the height of the Depression. There would be demonstrations asking for more money for relief or better conditions for relief workers. And the police would wade into these demonstrations with their nightsticks and break them up. And Stone felt that this guy needed to be gotten rid of. And so he organized a coalition where a lot of the kind of street-level work and organizing was done by communists because they were very energetic and they had good contacts. On the other hand, he had a committee of liberals, sort of people like Stephen Wise, the great Reform rabbi, and prominent people who were not radicals, but they were liberals, and socialists and anarchists. And he waged a campaign in his newspaper. And the great thing he found out was that the police department Red Squad had this official handbook of dangerous radicals, which was a book written by a woman called Elizabeth Dilling, who was a sort of red baiter in the 30s. And in fact, during the Second World War, was indicted for sedition because she was so pro-fascist. But the thing that Stone discovered is that in this handbook of dangerous reds used by the New York City Police Department, the mayor of New York, Fiorello LaGuardia, was listed as a dangerous red. So eventually that revelation and the campaign he put together got the police commissioner fired and replaced. But what it also did was it was a kind of model of what could be accomplished when socialists and communists and liberals all work together.
But I have Stone in his life before the 1950s and through the 1940s. Something happened, and the establishment press really began to turn against him, and he lost his work and had to create a world for himself.
Well, that's right. Just to take the history forward a little bit, Stone remained a very avid proponent of the Popular Front. until September 1939, when the Hitler, or August 1939, actually, when Ribbentrop and Molotov, the Soviet and the Nazi foreign ministers, signed their pact.
The Hitler-Stalin pact.
The Hitler-Stalin pact. And for Stone, this represented a complete betrayal of everything he'd been told the communists were supposed to be for, which was anti-fascism and opposition to Hitler. And Molotov famously at the time observed that opposition to fascism was a matter of taste, in his view. And Stone was furious. And he wrote against the pact in the Nation, and he wrote against the pact. By that time, he'd been fired from the New York Post, and he was working at the Nation, but he wrote against the pact in the Nation. He also wrote privately to a good friend of his who was, in a way, more within the communist orbit than he was. He said, "That's it. I'm off the Moscow axis. My fellow traveling days are over." Fellow traveler was someone who was not a member of the Communist Party but would cooperate with them and go sort of part of the way. That's why it's called a fellow traveler, with them on their programs. And Stone had been enthusiastically a fellow traveler from about 1933 till 1939. But he said, "That's it. It's over." Okay. So then his big cause in 1939 is to get the United States into the war. This is, of course, at a time when the Communist Party is opposed to the war, and so are Republican groups like America First,
you know, right.
Sort of the nativist groups. Stone is doing everything he can to get the U.S. into the war. In fact, he, partly to aid his effectiveness in this, because he didn't want to be dismissed as just a Jew who was trying to get the U.S. into a war to help the Jews of Europe, and also partly because of his genuine fear of fascism in the U.S., and I say this in the book, you know, in the end, I admire Stone, but there are things in his life that he did that are far from admirable. And this is the one I think that he felt the most embarrassment about in later life. He was born Isidore Feinstein. And in 1937, he changed his name from Isidore Feinstein to I.F. Stone. Now, part of the rationale for that was so that he could continue campaigning to get the U.S. into the war and not be dismissed so easily. But part of it also was fear. And he knew that it was partly based on fear, and he was a little bit embarrassed about it later on in life. Anyway, during the war, Stone is very influential, writing about the American defense industry, preparedness. Also, I should say that before the war in 1937, Stone wrote a book called The Court Disposes, which was an attack on the Supreme Court just before Roosevelt launched his court packing plan.
He was actually one of the few people in America who really backed Franklin Delano Roosevelt with his idea of packing the Supreme Court to make it a vehicle for social change.
Well, in the book, Stone said there were four ways you could reform the court, and he listed packing as the last and the least preferred option. It's not that he thought it was a good idea. What he did think, though, and a lot of people thought this, was that that the court, which was unelected, kept on striking down the laws that had been passed by the Congress and the president who'd been elected to do something about the Depression. I mean, you know, these were laws like unemployment compensation, social security insurance, minimum wage, maximum working hour laws. These were all being struck down by the Supreme Court. And essentially what happened is Roosevelt tried to pack the court. He lost that fight. But then one of the justices changed his mind and started supporting New Deal regulation. And another justice retired and allowed Roosevelt to replace him. And the balance on the court shifted, so it became a less crucial issue because the court started upholding New Deal laws. But my point about that is that Stone was very much an insider in the New Deal and at the Roosevelt White House. You know, he was someone who had access to lots of agencies. He knew lots of people. He had terrific contacts. He wrote speeches for Roosevelt. He had a very warm personal relationship with Tommy Corcoran, who was Roosevelt's main political fixer. In fact, Corcoran got Stone's father a job at the U.S. Mint in Philadelphia. So, you know, the image we have of Stone as this incorruptible outsider was definitely not true in the 1940s. I mean, he was, I'm not saying he was corrupt. He was a really successful, well-connected newspaper man like any other. His politics were left-wing, but he certainly was not above trading favors with people and the kind of things that you do in life. But what happened after Roosevelt died is that Truman came in. Now, Truman had actually been very close to I.F. Stone because Stone's main effort during the war was military preparedness, and Truman chaired a special Senate committee on the defense industries, and had been a good source for Stone, and Stone had publicized his work. But Truman's view of the world and the United and America's relationship with the Soviet Union was very different than Stone's, and very different from Franklin Roosevelt's. And so slowly, America started to turn to the right, and slowly Stone found himself more and more marginalized. And in fact, I opened my book with this episode in 1949, where
Meet the Press, that episode?
On Meet the Press.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, your listeners will know Meet the Press as a Sunday morning TV show. In fact, it started as a radio program. And when it was a radio program, Stone was a regular member of the panel. And indeed, he was also a regular member of the panel when it first began broadcasting on TV in 1946, 47, 48, 49. Well, it started on TV in 47.
Mm-hmm.
The woman who was the show's first producer told me they liked Stone because he was a good needler. You know, he was somebody who could be relied on to ask provocative questions and get under the skins of some of the sort of stuffed shirt interviewees they would have on. But in 1949, in December 1949, Stone was on the show with a man called Morris Fishbein. Dr. Morris Fishbein was at that time probably the most famous doctor in America. He was the editor of the Journal of the American Medical Association, and he was launching an attack on national health insurance because the AMA said that having a national health insurance would be socialistic.
Socialized medicine, as they term it.
Socialized medicine.
Yes, right.
Now, isn't that interesting? Does that sound a little familiar to your listeners? Stone turned to Fishbein and said, "Tell me, Dr. Fishbein, since President Truman has already come out in favor of national health insurance, do you think that makes him a dangerous communist or just a deluded fellow traveler?" And, Fishbein didn't like it. But there are two things about that broadcast that make it, I think, very interesting. One is that it was the last time I.F. Stone appeared on national television for the next 18 years. So that from having been a regular on Meet the Press and on lots of things, he basically disappeared. He became a disappeared person in the United States. And in fact, even though he was pretty famous towards the end of his life and was on the Today program and Dick Cavett and things like that, he was never invited back on Meet the Press again. But the second thing, which in a way is more significant, is that here we are 60 years later, and the conversation, the debate on national health, has it moved on? Has it moved on at all? Not really. And I think that's what's important, is that when you exclude voices like Stone, you can see the price we've paid politically in America by ruling out, by suppressing and denying radical opinions.
We're talking with D.D. Guttenplan, who is the London correspondent for Nation magazine. His latest book is American Radical, The Life and Times of I.F. Stone. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And we'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. D.D. Guttenplan has written the book, American Radical, The Life and Times of I.F. Stone. And when you left off a minute ago, we were... this idea of the importance of I.F. Stone, and I think that part of it is that, as you write and as people who knew him, as we talked before, we started this interview, that I wasn't, as by any stretch of imagination, a friend of Izzy Stone's, but I knew Izzy Stone because he stopped by our offices in Washington in the late 60s when I was at the Washington Free Press and later at Liberation News Service. And he was something of an icon for all of us because he was a guy who fought against the war and was not afraid to stand up against Lyndon Johnson and to say the war was wrong and even expose the world the reality of what the Gulf of Tonkin was. Now President Johnson lied about, and the government lied about the bombing to create this war in the Gulf of Tonkin in 64. So he was really an amazing human being. But one of the things about Stone is that he believed to his last drop of ink, the last punch of his typewriter key, that he could change the world, and that's how you even start. That's on the cover of your book, and he thought that journalism had a role, and as a fighting journalist, he had a role to make people aware and to fight for things he believed in, and I think he's like almost in some ways the symbolic grandfather of bloggers. But that's another subject. Let's just start with the first thing about his belief in change.
Well, I think I think it's absolutely true. I think that he wrote, like Karl Marx and like other muckraking journalists, he wrote to change the world, not just to sell newspaper or to sell soaps or dog food. And I think also it's interesting to me, though, you said you knew him at Liberation News Service. I mean, that's part of what attracted me to Stone, and it's part of what I think is a very important part of this story, is that those of us on the left in America, sometimes it seems as if we think we're reinventing the wheel every 30 years, and we have no memory of our predecessors and what they did and what they learned and the struggles they fought and what they handed on to us. Mm-hmm. And I think what was so interesting about Stone is here's somebody who saw himself as very much a muckraker, which is to say someone in the journalistic line of Upton Sinclair or Ida Tarbell or Wendell Phillips, you know, the people who wrote against the big trusts or Standard Oil in the 1900s, the people like who wrote exposing the color line in the South, you know, in 1920 and 1930. He thought of all of these people as his forebears, his mentors, and as part of what he was doing. You know, he was carrying on their enterprise. So by simply writing the truth about what the government is up to, you can inspire people to take action. And, you know, there was what I thought was great was that he is this figure who carries these values from the 20s and the 30s into the 60s and, you know, inspired people like you and the other people at Liberation News and, you know, young journalists across the country, and in a way still inspires generations of bloggers who read his stuff or have heard of his example and think, yeah, I'm gonna get the truth out there. I'm going to get the truth out there. I'm going to dig for it. I mean, Stone said famously that all governments lie, but he also said, but they can't keep, the truth slips out. You know, they all lie, but they also have to let out so much information that if you know where to look, you can find the truth. And I think he saw that as his task, and that in a way does connect him with bloggers, but we can talk about their differences later on.
There are some differences, but that was his power. And he also was not afraid to, I remember, and I think you mentioned in your book, I think you mentioned, I'm sure you mentioned it in the book, that in 1965, when there was this raging anti-war movement, and people hated, really viscerally disliked Lyndon Baines Johnson because of the war, he also wrote this piece that I found the other night in my stash in the basement of old I.F. Stone weeklies. This piece about that Lyndon Baines Johnson, if it wasn't for the war, would be a hero of the left.
Yes, well, he wrote, you know, when Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act, Stone wrote that he stood and watched the president's car, you know, leave the Congress where he'd signed the bill, and he said he felt like standing up and cheering. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is the man who he was battering every day over the war. I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that there are two things that I think make Stone very different from today's sort of Sunday morning pundits, the kind of people who you do see on Meet the Press. One is that he was prepared to change his mind and be surprised.
Yes.
When the Russians sent Sputnik into space and all of these commentators were rushing to say, oh, this is no surprise. I wasn't surprised by this. Stone said, well, so what? You weren't surprised. A mummy isn't surprised. If you're not surprised, then you're not open to things. You're not learning anything. But the other thing I think that set him apart is that he saw shades of gray. He saw shades of gray. I mean, part of it is that all his life, he maintained a willingness to take his opponents seriously, to listen to their arguments, to engage with them civilly, which was something that a lot of us had trouble doing in the 60s. But also, he saw that sometimes there are conflicts where there's virtue on both sides. I mean, I think this was the key to his understanding, his early and prophetic understanding of Israel and the Palestinians. But also, one of my favorite stories is he was speaking on campus towards the end of his life, you know, when we became a little bit more, our culture became a little bit more righteous. And somebody said to him, how can you say, because he always called himself a Jeffersonian Marxist.
Right, right. I love that term. Thomas Jefferson. Love that term.
Well, you know, Jefferson said that if he had to have a government without newspapers or newspapers without a government, he'd always prefer newspapers without
That's
a government.
Right.
So,
That's right.
You know, I think all newspaper men have to be Jeffersonians. Someone said, how can you say you admire Thomas Jefferson, you know, this evil man who owned slaves and fathered slaves and was, you know, complicit in this horrible institution, which, of course, it was a horrible institution. And Stone said, well, it's because history is a tragedy, not a melodrama. And I think it was that sense of history as a tragedy that kept him from being, that saved him in a way from being glib.
Well, he was also, I think there's a lot about I.F. Stone, and I see what you think about this, that I think that you kind of say as much in your book in different ways, that it a lot had to do with who he was. As to grow up Jewish in the early part of the 20th century and to be part of that world, or even to be a child of somebody of that world, that it gave you a sense of history where history was a tragedy, and B, it gave you a connection to other people of the world who were oppressed that he very much embodied.
Well, I think, you know, the experience of oppression was not abstract for him. I mean, you know, he grew up in New Jersey in a country town where the Ku Klux Klan paraded down the street in the 20s, and where they had stickers on the trolley, which was the sort of above-ground car that you would take to get to Camden, which was the local big city, ran right past his parents' store. And there were stickers all over the trolleys in Camden in the 20s saying, every loyal American knows what KKK stands for. And in the book, I talk about the story where when they paraded down the street, they paraded, of course, wearing hoods and robes. But the local police chief was someone who was a conspicuously tall man, 6'4", something like that. And Stone's little brother saw the police chief the next day after the parade in the store, and he said, oh, I saw you in the parade yesterday, because, of course, he'd recognized him. So, you know, there was a sense in which it was not an abstract experience for him. But interestingly, he did not react to it by becoming parochial. I think that's interesting, too. I mean, Stone was someone who also wrote in the 1950s, he wrote again and again about the situation of African Americans in the U.S., and he basically thought that America did not deserve the patience of its African Americans, that they were too patient, they should be noisier and uppityer. And he wrote, the American Negro needs a Gandhi to lead him, and we need the American Negro to lead us.
Right.
Meaning that he understood very early that the civil rights struggle would have to be led by blacks themselves. And that was, again, you know, that set him apart from a lot of white liberals.
Well, and that had a lot to do also with, I think, his sense of being a radical. And he understood and always understood that the struggle for black liberation, for the end of segregation, and would be led and had to be led by African-American people, and that they also, in many ways, are always the forefront of battles in America and would kind of lead the struggle. And he knew that. I mean, that was his kind of understanding of how America worked.
That's right. He knew it from history, and he knew it viscerally, both, I think. I think that's right.
And he was a person, I mean, you're right about leading up to World War II, and how he was one of the few voices out there saying, we have to fight fascism, we have to fight the Nazis. And when the war came, he all of a sudden, as you write, I think your line in your book is something about, he all of a sudden became respectable. And that he kind of hobnobbed with some of the power players of Washington, but that didn't stop him. He didn't let that kind of seduce him into being in love with power.
Well, you know, I think it's true that he didn't let it seduce him into being in love with power. And I think it's also true that he probably did have a choice after the war was over. You know, he could have changed his politics. He could have modulated. I mean, it's interesting to compare him with somebody like Max Lerner, who was a good friend of his in the 30s.
Right.
And their politics were almost identical. The two men were actually having breakfast together the day that war was declared on Poland. And Lerner got Stone his job on the New York Post, I mean, on The Nation. He was the first, he brought Stone into The Nation as his summer replacement. And then Stone was on PM, and Lerner became for a while his boss as chief editorial writer, because Stone was, he was a Washington correspondent, but he was also writing editorials for PM. And they respected each other very much. They were very friendly. But then after after World War II, Lerner essentially went with the Americans for Democratic Action, the sort of anti-communist liberals, so that by 1954, when the United States is invading Guatemala to get rid of a left-wing government, Lerner is justifying it because he said, well, that government, the president of that government who was elected was taking economic advice from communists, mm-hmm. so of course we had to get rid of him. So, you know, there were plenty of people who changed their politics and remained in favor with those in power. And Stone didn't do that. And in a way, you know, I don't underline the point in the book, but of course he could have done that.
He could have done that. And I think that I mean, that's the kind of the power of Stone in many ways, that he wasn't seduced. He was such an individualist and an iconoclast that he couldn't be seduced by left, right, anybody. I mean, he just followed his own path and fought what he saw as the truth. And I think that's...
Well, that's part of it.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, it's all right. I mean, I think it's interesting because, you know, after Stone died, by the time Stone died, he was very much a respectable figure.
Right.
You know, when he died, every single network news broadcast reported his death. Peter Jennings on the ABC News gave him a sort of a minute and a half of eulogy mm-hmm. the day after he died, calling him a journalist. His death was reported on the front page of the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, you know, the Washington Post, the LA Times, Le Monde. You know, he got obituaries around the world. He was very much an institution, like he said. But it's interesting that he's still being attacked. I mean, even in 2007, when George W. Bush was making a speech to the veterans of foreign wars, he attacked I.F. Stone and his book, The Hidden History of the Korean War, as an example of the kind of illegitimate criticism that sometimes happens during wartime. You know, and he was obviously comparing himself to Truman and basically saying that, you know, those who are attacking me are as bad as I.F. Stone, who wrote this terrible book, The Hidden History of the Korean War. And more recently, he's been attacked. There have been sort of smears attempting to claim that he was either in the pay of the Soviets, he was cooperating with Soviet intelligence. And I think in a way, what's interesting about that is partly that these things keep coming, and in a way they've become more intense after his death than they were during his lifetime. But secondly, I think what makes them both ridiculous and probably also provides the impetus for them is that anybody who takes a look at Stone's actual writings, in other words, who reads through the weeklies or looks at his collections, realizes that he couldn't be pigeonholed. It's not that he was a contrarian. It's not that he didn't have consistent views. He had very consistent politics. He was always a radical. You know, whenever there was an underdog, he was on the side of the underdog. But, you know, he pokes his finger in the eye of the Soviet Union. He pokes his finger in the eye of the new left when he feels that they were getting doctrinaire. In the 1960s, when sort of anti-war protests were getting more and more militant, he said, we have to decide whether we're a peace movement or a different kind of war movement, because if we're a different kind of war movement, we're never going to succeed. And if we're a peace movement, we have to get the people who are trying to have their own war movement out of our movement. So, you know, he wasn't afraid of speaking not just truth to power, but also truth to his friends. And I think it's that independence that makes him still dangerous to the right, because of course if they can depict him as someone who was just a Moscow hireling, someone who was a sort of lockstep obedient servant of Stalinism, then his example isn't dangerous. Then no continuing generations of young people will try and emulate him, and power will have less to fear. But you know, if you concede that it is possible to be both a Jeffersonian and a Marxist, if you concede that you can be radical and independent, then, you know, that's scary.
It's very scary. We're talking about Izzy Stone, I.F. Stone, one of the great journalists and thinkers and activists of our time. The book is American Radical, The Life and Times of I.F. Stone by D.D. Guttenplan, who is The Nation magazine's London correspondent. And even up into the 60s, and as you write about in your chapter, American Tragedy, he, not so much in the face of the young radicals of the day, but in the face of liberals, he would defend Stokely Carmichael, Malcolm X. He understood where they were coming from, understood why they felt the way they felt. And he had a broader view of it analytically. And again, a lot of that he hearkened back to his roots that changed him so much when he was in Palestine and Israel during the war of 1948, and how that shaped his view of kind of oppression. He was really very interesting in his view, because it really did take on the liberal establishment when it came to things like that.
Well, I think the piece he wrote for the New York Review of Books, because when he closed I.F. Stone's Weekly in 1971 and essentially sold his subscription list to the New York Review of Books and became a contributing editor there. And the piece he wrote for them about Malcolm X after Malcolm was assassinated is an astonishing piece of writing, because it's hard to think of two people who could be more different than, you know, this sort of small-time criminal from Harlem who then becomes, has this conversion experience in prison and becomes this great both black nationalist leader and Muslim spiritual leader. Because Stone, although very proudly Jewish and fiercely Jewish all his life, also said he was a Jewish atheist all his life. So
right.
Stone, you know, was not a spiritual person in any conventional sense. And yet you can see, it's palpable in the writing, a real identification with Malcolm and a real identification with not so much black nationalism as a cause, but the effect of it. And I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right to say that it goes back to his own childhood and his own experiences, because Stone basically saw, by going to Israel and going to Palestine, he saw what nationalism could do. First of all, he'd seen the Jewish people in Europe in 1945 and 1946 were in a place that was at least comparably bad to the situation of American blacks before the civil rights movement. You know, they had been, you know, two-thirds of them had been murdered. They had no place to live. They had no rights. So, you know, you could get into comparatives, which is worse. All I'm saying is that it was clearly terrible. And Stone saw what the state of Israel had done for those people, that this phase of militant nationalism, whatever, however else you might criticize it, because he was not in favor of militant nationalism for the Jews, and he was not in favor of militant nationalism for blacks. But his view was that from outside it, it's easy to criticize it, but you have to understand what it means for the people who are inside it and what it gives them in terms of pride and a sense of identity and a sense of being able to deal with the terrible oppression that they go through every day. So, you know, he really had, I think, a very deep understanding for a white person, speaking as another white person, mm-hmm. of black nationalism and its appeals. I mean, I think, you know, he my suspicion is he would have hoped that eventually the nationalist phase could have been transcended, just as he hoped that the nationalist phase for Jews could be transcended.
A couple of things I just want to touch on quickly, and I want to wrap up with your thoughts about the power of I.F. Stone's legacy for many people today in the world that we live in of journalism and what we should remember. But very quickly, I mean, there are some things I think are really interesting in your last chapter that really hit me. That with things like his actually taking on this state of Israel, and as you write, he kind of harkened back to the days of Echad Chaim, who created the Hebrew alphabet and the Hebrew language, was a great poet, Martin Buber, the philosopher, to kind of preach this unity with Arabs. I mean, he really took a different stance. That was a pretty brave stance to take.
It was a very brave stance to take, and for him it was a particularly brave and in some ways painful stance to take, because when Stone first went to Palestine in 1945, he was not a Zionist, he was not an anti-Zionist, and that was true of most American Jews. When he went on his journey with the illegal immigration, the Eliyah Beit, in 1946 on a ship from Europe to Palestine and ran the British blockade, he was again not a conventional Zionist, but he saw, because he had been to the refugee camps, that those people had no place to go and they wanted to go to Palestine. What he hoped is that they would be allowed to go to Palestine, but that there would be created in Palestine a binational state of both Jews and Arabs. When the state of Israel came into being, he realized that neither Jews nor Arabs particularly supported his view of what they should be doing. He certainly cherished the state of Israel, reported on its war of independence, you know, was deeply invested in its survival. But he also wrote again and again that until Israel, well, first of all, he noticed that there were other people there. That was the thing that set Stone's reporting,
right.
even from 1945 and
right.
1946, apart is he noticed Palestinians were there, and he could just never bring himself to pretend that they didn't exist. And so if they're there and if they exist, okay, we have a right to, we have a claim to the land. You know, we have the right, as his friend Amos Ilan wrote, you have the right to the same, a drowning man has a right to a piece of driftwood even if somebody else is already on the driftwood. You don't have a right to push him off and make him drown, though. And, you know, that was Stone's view of Israel in the Middle East, and it remained his view all his life. But what was, where it required heroism was during the late 1940s and early 1950s, just as, in a way, the American left was being chased out of existence by the witch hunts, Stone had a whole new public because he was writing about Israel, and he was the most important American journalist, the most prominent journalist writing about the new state. He wrote a coffee table book, This is Israel, with the photographer Robert Capa. He was constantly on the speaking circuit. So he had a whole new audience. And yet he found himself forced to tell this new audience things that they didn't want to hear.
So in conclusion, Dan Guttenplan, we only have a few minutes left. I'd just like you to kind of wrap up for us the power of I.F. Stone. And we never really got a chance to talk about the blogger issue, which you may can touch on for a moment here. But what I.F. Stone has to say to young journalists, to bloggers, to activists, and how it's about the world that we inhabit and what we should expect of ourselves. Just what your conclusion of that is from his life.
Sure. Well, I think for activists and for young journalists, one thing he has to say is, and one thing that makes his writing so resonant is he had a sense of history. So have a sense of history. Have a sense of what people in the struggle before you have done, and have a sense of what people in your business before you have done. For bloggers, I think what's interesting about Stone was, first of all, that, you know, it's pretty easy to build an audience as a blogger if you tell people what they want to hear. And if you're constantly, you know, hitting a note that satisfies your audience and making them happy. But Stone basically said that you have to be prepared to upset your audience. You have to be prepared to tell them what they don't want to hear. And that, in a way, that's what justifies your existence. So, you know, that's one thing that I would say differentiates him from a lot of bloggers, and maybe it's something bloggers could learn from him. But the other key thing about Stone and the blogosphere is that, unlike bloggers, Stone found an audience who was willing to pay to read what he had to say. He put three kids through college. He supported a family. He bought a very nice house, all on the proceeds, $5 a year. So he had to have a lot of subscribers of I.F. Stone's Weekly. So, you know, for the news business, I would say Stone's lesson is don't give your content away.
That's an interesting way to end the life of I.F. Stone for this hour anyway. Dede Guttenplan, thank you so much for writing this book and for taking the hour with us.
It's been great talking with you.
It's been a pleasure. The book is American Radical, The Life and Times of I.F. Stone by Dede Guttenplan, Guttenplan, on Farrar, Straus, Giroux. And before we go, we want to thank legendary Larry Josephson at Radio Foundation for engineering on that end, and on our end, Nick Shostrom here at Clean Cuts. And once again, Dan Guttenplan, thank you. It's been a pleasure to have you on the air with us. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ was formed in 1936 to help people during the Great Depression. And over 70 years later, they're still here to help people during difficult times. More information is available at mecu.com. The Mark Steiner Show is produced by the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Jessica Phillips. We're engineered at WEAA by Zachary Coleman. Our interns are Christina Arison, Judith Lloyd, Brian Boone, and Jackson Hubold. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again and podcast any of our past shows and hear additional interviews, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. For Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.